past transitions to current transition or transitions. The person who was sitting up there last night that said, I'm not in any. I wish we'd had time long to talk to her. I used to talk that way. You might want to do that a couple ways, thinking about current transitions. If you're in multiple transitions, now pick one that you want to look at this time. That you want to kind of think about and analyze maybe and get some insight into. Or if you're in just one, pick that one, but I'd like you to kind of keep that in mind now as we talk about transitions now. And we've got a choice at this point. We've got a message from Hagar here. Rating ain't what it used to be. Weapons cost a fortune. The crew wants more money. Castles are tougher to take. How do they expect me to make an honest living? I'm sick of the business of sacking and looting. I might find a new job. Like what? Exploring. I'd sail unknown seas to discover fantastic new worlds and fabulous isles. Then what would you do? Gee, I don't know. Sack and loot, I guess. He's not in any, what goes around comes around with him, and he doesn't see much hope in this transition. It's going to end up the way it was before. Either that, but we hope it'd be more like our friend Pogo. Friends, we are surrounded by insurmountable opportunity. He's more today is the first day of the rest of your life type thing. The truth usually falls somewhere in between. We were talking last night. We keep working on the same issues, but we progress. Maybe it's retrograde motion, I don't know. Or up and down with the overall pack. Hope we get wiser as we grow older. And that's really what we're doing this weekend, trying to figure out some patterns here, maybe make it a little more predictable. So as you think about your current transition, you can think of various patterns that you have experienced in that exercise you did with Ruth. You probably saw some kind of pattern there as you work through that previous transition. Your style of saying goodbye at a party, how did you say goodbye to number one? And how did you move through that middle ground? And what techniques did you develop? Now, none of us here is a stranger to transition. We've all developed techniques for dealing with it. And how did you get into the third one? I thought Dwight before had an interesting way of describing transition as this one pattern of thinking. Would you care to share that?
Talking about the biological one?
Yeah.
So my background is biology, and I think some of you know that there are two different ways that insects develop, either complete metamorphosis, which is the worm and the pupa and the butterfly. We're just going through that. You see the cartoon where the two worms are humping along the road and this butterfly is going over and one worm turns to the other and says, "You'll never get me up in one of those." but the other is incomplete metamorphosis, in which the insect, when it's born, looks like it will always look, but it's a particular moment of its life that goes along with this kind of a shell that's protected, not too vulnerable, and then there comes the moment when it splits the shell and emerges, and it's very, very vulnerable. It's soft, it's tender, very vulnerable to the prey of other insects or those birds or other kinds of things. And then it takes a period of time in which it's rebuilding again that hard surface, and it goes on like that for a while, then it'll break out of that one. And it's felt to me like the process we're talking about is pretty identical to that. You're in the old, and then you're in that extremely vulnerable position of being without the old shell but not having the new one, and then moving on to the new one.
As you were telling, I was thinking of running out of the east. I thought soft shell crabs were a species that you eat.
Oh,
it's a transition.
Oh.
They're in between shells.
Oh.
And it's when you eat them. Oh. And it's kind of like what you were talking about.
Could we just take a vote and see how many would like to leave the party, just slip out?
Okay, let's, we've had two patterns of saying goodbye. One is you shake hands with everybody, the other one you kind of dribble off the side. Any other patterns that you recognize to yourself?
Well, I go to the door and I say, goodbye, everybody! That's why I do it. And then I get out before I have a chance to cry about it.
Oh.
So I have to be the last one out, so then there's nobody left. I hang around, I already do, I hang around.
Other patterns?
Oh, I put my coat on.
Go ahead.
I do the same thing when I'm saying goodbye on the telephone or leaving someone's house. I have to say, well, suppose, three times. It takes at least an hour to do that.
Put on your coat and talk about leaving.
Mm-hmm.
But don't do it.
Sometimes you say goodbye to just some people. Maybe not go to everybody, but maybe just the people that you know best, or just the host and hostess.
Okay. I just love to slip out.
Why the slip? Do any of you promise stuff to make it look like you're not really saying goodbye? We'll keep in touch.
Yeah.
Somebody might say, we'll do this and we'll do that.
I used to. I'll call you.
Yeah. And that makes it seem like, well, this isn't really goodbye.
Right.
Let's get together for lunch.
Yeah. Have lunch. My father was a burial vault maker, so I had a lot to do with that business that I grew up with. So I kind of watched the patterns as we say goodbye to the deceased, from making them look as lifelike as possible, and wanting to remember them that way and to see them again that way sometimes. Different patterns, different ways, but it's not trying to hang on to quite as much. Well, you want to vote on this?
Yes, it's too varied.
Yeah.
You're normal.
Yeah.
Okay. One extreme is saying goodbye to every single person in the room and formally meeting closure with that person, as they say, to silently slipping away without saying anything as the two extremes. Let's just look at those two extremes. We've seen all the gradations in between. How many are the saying goodbye to every person in the room? If you're on zero, how many are on this side of zero saying goodbye to everybody in the room to make a formal departure? How many people do that? One, two, three, four, five, six, seven, eight, nine, ten.
11.
How many? 11. Okay. Right. Were you the person that said you weren't in any transitions last night?
No.
Okay. I don't want to be that person.
How many people kind of try to sneak out without being known? One, two, three, four, five, six, seven, eight, nine.
I was going to comment that the way you leave, though, may be predicated on your concept of how you function in that group. There's some people, if they're at a party or something, they feel they have to talk to everybody. I mean, that something's wrong if they haven't introduced themselves to everybody and connected with everybody. I think there are other people that don't feel they have to do that. So,
right. Yeah, somebody wants to hug and kiss me after we've just met 3 minutes ago. You know, right?
Well, part of leave-taking, though, is you notice I raised my hand on the one side and he raised his hand on the other. So who you're there with, you know, also may influence how quickly you can get out.
Would you like to talk a little bit?
I'd love to. I go out and warm up the car. The point of this discussion is whatever suits you. And it might be appropriate, and you could get the same benefit. The person that slips out and get just as much benefit from that, unless they're trying to avoid something, as the person who must say goodbye and shake hands with everybody as they leave. The point is, how do you make closure? How do you end the experience? As you're thinking about the one you want to talk about, the particular transition you're in now, Levinson and Erickson have a few things to say about issues we might be dealing with. there's Levinson's stages of life. You can peg yourself on here all the way from age 0 to age 80 and see
where you are on that, because there's different issues we're dealing with
as you go through those different stages of life. Are you in middle adulthood, or settling down, or entering the adult world, wherever you are? You might want to think about that. But then if you carry that over to Erickson, this is what he says. Now, the questions you're dealing with, you see that as you're going through these various stages of adult development and pre-adult also, and you just get done dealing with one of these issues, and guess what you do then? You get to deal with the next one. That's the reward. So let's pick up, there's nobody here in infancy or preschool or primary or junior high, teen. Okay, I'll stop right there making predictions. Might be in one of these, dealing intimacy versus isolation in early adult life, or generativity versus stagnation. I had to deal with that when we moved to Chicago, because Ruth had the job and she was generating, and my greatest fear was becoming stagnant. We could survive financially, but I had this image that the word drone kept coming back. It kept coming into my mind. I didn't want to be a drone and hanger on or something like that, so I had to generate my own activities and find environments in which people wanted my gifts. And then as we get elderly, Erickson says the last stage is, as you look back, you see any red threads running through your life and kind of pull it all together, or do you say, no, nihilistic, that didn't make any sense whatsoever, and you give into despair. And nobody's in one camp or the other, you know, you're bouncing back and forth between those. But it's kind of, what issue are you dealing with? That has something to do with your transitions. Mm-hmm.
Could I just comment? I recently heard a presentation that said at the time that Erickson dreamed this up, people weren't living as long as they are now. So what he thought of as elderly was not living to be 100, mm-hmm. but that was probably ending at the most 80. Mm-hmm. And so this woman has come up with a new stage for from 85 to 100. Which is resolution versus vegetation. So if you click into elderly there as your parents who are maybe in their 90s, that's not quite where they are.
And she's got a whole different way of dealing with that, right? Mm-hmm. It's how you counsel somebody. Okay, on your outline you had for the first session, which we're going to get to, something called categories of changes or transitions. And I appreciate it if you'd throw in examples here to get us thinking along these lines. The first one is losses of relationships. That could happen if you gain or lose a friend, you gain or lose a spouse, your parents die, or you give birth in a family, or the children leave. Relationships change, the nature of the relationship changes. Other examples in your life think of in this category?
Teachers to pupils.
Teachers
end
to
pupils. End of every school year.
Yeah.
Well, friends at work, when you change jobs, you lose a lot of friends and ties.
Right. We noticed when the kids left, they formed, helped form our relationships on the ball fields. We were friends with parents, like these kids. Somebody else was going to bring it up.
When you move from one place to another, I mean, you're leaving one social group and you're going to another, you have those relationships.
And the mode in which the relationship is carried on may change. I mean, they move to literary then, you got to write letters or telephone to maintain a relationship, whereas before you saw them all the time.
I had a tremendous loss of relationship as I had two daughters that got married within 4.5 months of each other, and they were 28 and 32 at the time. And I had established adult relationships with them, friendships with them. And I could not believe the anger that I felt when my daughters, and it was, I wanted them to be married. It was a wonderful thing. That was, you know, part of their their thing. But I was surprised at the anger and the loss that I felt because things were going to change.
That's good. Good example.
At their daughters or their spouses?
Losing my daughters. Seemingly a loss of that same type of relationship that we had. Now somebody else was in the picture, and so that wasn't as free flowing as it, I mean, they weren't as free to get in touch with me and let me keep nurturing them how they nurture me.
I've heard all these wonderful stories about, oh, we haven't lost a daughter, we've gained a son. That's a bunch of baloney. I hated those guys.
Yes, anger.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Not toward the daughter, but that.
Yeah,
the
loss is the daughter, but the anger is gone.
There was a couple in one of our workshops that she said, so irritated to me to think that a male was getting intimate with my daughter.
Yeah, yeah.
After marriage.
Yeah.
It took her a while to adjust to that.
Yeah.
And I think it's interesting, our elder got married a year ago, August, and there's no word in the English language for the relationship between you and the parents of the person your child married.
Mm-hmm.
What do you call it? You always gotta say our daughter's parents, our daughter-in-law's parents. And we're trying to, when I get to Philadelphia, I try and have dinner with them. You know, it's interesting. Okay. Changes in home life. And the person I asked to do these overheads, when we left, decided he didn't like two.
You talked last night about some people go straight from one to two.
That's right. You could not stand moving through two. You jump from one to three. Okay, but changes in home life. Can you think of examples there?
Kids moving away from home.
Kids moving away, right?
Or moving back in.
Moving.
Yeah. New
babies.
New babies.
Mm-hmm. A little body in the house.
Stepchildren.
Good.
Change in situations. For example, we've had our own private home before. Now we're still in private.
Mm-hmm. Good. From a nuclear family to an extended family.
Well, I would think for a lot of folks, you know, like this big transition of going from their own home into, for example, a nursing home, mm-hmm. or into an area, into a smaller setting where they have to get rid of or pare down their belongings.
Yeah, move from a home to a house to a condo.
To a condo.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The importance placed on keeping it clean changes as you, I mean, you know, and decorating and all that kind of stuff changes.
Mm-hmm.
I clean by candlelight.
Right. I put up candles so I don't have to clean.
Well, see what you
Any others you've experienced in your home life? Work and financial changes. That could be, you win the lottery. You hear all the stories about people who won the lottery. We all like to do it, but for many, you can't make the transition. Because relatives feel they should help them out, and people who work feel they should help them out. They just don't know how to manage money. Like that, you can change your job. You can become either unemployed or you get a promotion. Either way. I was working with a man who was making something like $60,000 or $65,000 a year. It was about 10 years ago. He was making big money. They promoted him from being a hands-on salesperson to training salespersons. And he just hated it. Because he liked to sell. He liked to teach and train. And while we were working together on his career, he got a $15,000 a year raise. And it made him even madder. Because he couldn't get out of it. Mm-hmm. Couldn't go back to just being a salesperson.
I had an experience the other day where my husband is really looking forward to retirement. And so we know that that's going to be a lot less money. And so I was had a backache, and I said, I should go see the chiropractor. And we're in the store, we're in the grocery shop. And he says, well, he says, you know, you better get used to that, because when we retire, you know, you aren't going to be able to run to the chiropractor. And so I said, what you're saying now is you want me to start changing now. Don't go to the chiropractor. We still, we have our health benefit, you know, and the insurance pays for it. But I just thought, that is so stupid of you to say that to me, that I should suffer now, so I'll be used to it by the time.
That is a very interesting point. It's relevant to this one here. I find myself grieving my father's death occasionally. He's not dead.
Oh.
I see him losing his powers and his personality. And so you do some pre-transition
yes. mm-hmm.
work before the event actually happens.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And yet you find yourself in that kind of situation where you're expecting something to happen. Nothing's happened outside yet. Something's starting to happen inside.
I've seen, you talked about Kubler-Ross's stages of grieving and so on. I've seen people go through all of those prior to the death of a spouse, and at the time of the funeral and burial, there's no evidence of one lady was making a date with the Undertaker. I mean, she was ready to start re-entry already.
Good point. You start your own business. I'm talking about major transition. You move from one mode of employment to a different mode of employment. I'm taking orders from somebody to giving orders. That can be a major change.
Re-enter school, education, and have a new career.
Okay. Yeah, going back to school, that's a new career, major. Just to be treated, sit on the other side of the desk. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's very, very different.
Maybe
I'm
you
forgetting
have,
your name.
Patty,
yeah.
Or maybe you'll have changes in administration in your job, where you yourself may have the same thing to do, but maybe the higher-ups are different, so, you know, things are kind of different.
That is an excellent point in the area of career, because sometimes if you can't pinpoint what it is that's doing it, you throw out the baby with the bathwater, and you think you don't like the functions of your job. And all it's at, working with one person, she was negative, happened to be a pastor, wanted to get out of this town, get out of church and everything. And she went back and told the church council she wanted a different office, and she wanted a window in that office. Seem to change things. You can put your finger on it. Maybe it's the change of boss. Don't get out of that job unless you determine it is the job itself. And finally, inner changes, a couple examples. We found decade birthdays to be kind of interesting. That can trigger an interchange sometimes. It was interesting to me, the week I turned 40 was the first time in my life I ever got glasses and I had root canal. That week. You know, just found myself waiting for the next system to break down. And I was wondering what was cause and effect there in that situation. Then he turned 50, 30. We were not quite, kind of in the generation said don't trust anybody over 30, and then we were. You know? And then what? So that can trigger an interchange.
Health changes.
Health changes. Change of physical prowess. Want to tell your story?
Sure. Vision therapy is actually retraining the eyes to work more efficiently, or as they were intended to work. And through my entire life, I was told that a lazy eye could not be corrected, so I had to live with it. When I was 44, I met a doctor who said, we can try this. And we did, and what I now have is depth perception for the first time in my life. Instead of seeing things on a two-plane level, I see them in their full dimension. I read faster, I comprehend more, I remember more of what I read. In college would be readings compared to what it was reading every sentence three times over to get the meaning out. You know, I mean, I really struggled to do what I did. This is profound.
You cool down downstairs.
And it has its... Basically, it's upsides, but then, as I told them, some definite backlash. There's a profound mourning for the life I didn't get. There's profound anger at doctors who never told me that this option was available. So that's why I mentioned last night I had gone into counseling. And fortunately, the lady I chose because she had done vision therapy as an adult and understood the profound nature of what happens when you perceive. It's not simply a matter of what you see. My husband, interestingly enough, right after I did this, said, am I good enough for you now? And the psychologist told me that on some level, he is sensing that you now see all of him. Mm-hmm. You don't take him at face value anymore. Uh-huh. So it's really affected our marriage, too.
What I thought of when you were talking was two. Sometimes we get about three quarters of the way stage two, and we think, boy, I'll be glad when I get out of here. This new thing, I get scared. Think of the new freedom I'll have on stage three. Think of the new opportunities I'll have. It gets scary.
Mm-hmm.
Got a friend that used to talk about faith. He had a collie, and the chain was 20 feet long on this collie. And the dog would always race at the end of the 20 feet, get a good jerk back, you know, and couldn't go any further than that. So they took the chain off, and the dog would only run 20 feet. Mm-hmm. To where the chain used to be. We can't stand it to get rid of the chain sometimes because they're too familiar. And we get afraid of moving into the depth perception, seeing things in a new way.
Another, I think, profound change there. My uncle told it to me most graphically. It's like getting stiff in all the wrong places. And I was thinking of the sexual functioning associated with midlife changes in I speak from inside a man's skin. And changes and the impact that has on me and I presume other men as well, where your identity is so closely associated with your sexuality.
Yeah, we'll talk about midlife change a little bit later. We'll talk about it now. I'm an ESTJ, so we've got to talk about it later. And then you start trying to prove it. I got to prove it that I haven't changed. Mm-hmm. And kill yourself trying to prove it. Okay.
Following along with bridges, and I think, I don't know, when your person put that down, he lists, one was left out if you were following bridges, and what we've been talking about are personal changes, eating, habits, sleep, sexual lifestyle, and then he had inner changes as being more spiritual awakenings, and so there seems to be one of them, if you were following bridges, yeah. Got left out.
Well, this guy is not into personal changes. I don't know why he left it up.
Well, it's also interesting, I think, from my own life experience of inner changes which created work and financial changes. My choice to come and live at Holden for a variety of reasons created work and financial changes, which is very dramatic. I remember Mark Thompson, our executive director of Global Mission, saying to me, "Wow, you're taking a pay cut?"
You what?
It costs $26,000. Are you taking a pay cut? I said, well, yeah. But that's not the point.
Yeah.
And it was hard to express that to him at the time. That wasn't the point. Although it certainly has created an impact here.
The, where was, oh, has anybody read the Popcorn Report here? Faith Popcorn, her boss could never pronounce her name, which is Potemkin, and called it. That there would be great turmoil. People would reject that. And Cope laughed at her and did it.
Uh-huh.
So she's got a big name now because she predicted what would happen. So she, there's a book out now called Popcorn, a report in which she's predicting what's going to happen for the rest of the 90s and into the 2000s. And one of her predictions is that people will take up to a 40% pay cut to get into something that passes the bus. She calls it cashing in. They're doing it, especially here in the Northwest, to cash in California. Come up to Chelan and buy a house for $125,000, take an $8 an hour job and live like king because they sold a $450,000 house in California. Well, she's saying people will cash in, take a 40% pay cut in order to get into a lifestyle that's more. So that's very true.
It's not only that they will, they are.
And they are, yeah. Usually these predictions are happening as they're being predicted.
We did that in the late 70s, what's new? Yeah.
Okay, let's look at some of the aspects of pendings. And this got back to Scott was asking about this a little bit last night. What are some of the things that happen in endings? You're leaving the outer circumstances. You move from overseas back to the United States. Okay? Your daughter gets married and moves away. There's disengagement. The outer circumstances change, and as we said last night, that can trigger the inner changes. Yeah. Other disengagements you've experienced? Breaking an engagement is a disengagement. What was that movie we saw? French Lieutenant's Wife.
Woman.
French Lieutenant's Woman. The guy broke the engagement in 19th century England and had to make a public proclamation of how bad he was. It was a disengagement that cost him severely. Change or loss of identity. Our self-definition changes. So, I used to be a father, and that meant setting curfews and giving allowances, and settling disputes, things like that. Now it means a few phone calls a year. And I better not try and play it the way I used to, because it'll hurt them if I try and maintain that identity that I had before. It would be inappropriate. So, or going from husband to just non-husband. You know, I'm not a husband anymore. A separation occurs. Going from respected worker, there was a person on, what's the channel, 2-1 in the morning, Good Morning America, whatever it is, got fired and sued. And they hired him back, gave him all the money, the compensation, hired him back, you know, job where he was working for somebody he had trained and brought into the corporation. And he talked about how demeaning it was. It changed his perception, self-perception. So identity literally changes. I work a lot with pastors who have been burned out. Well, we used to more, and still do occasionally. In those situations, oftentimes they have identified their character, or their person, with a particular way of delivering their skills, such as preaching. And if something happens that you lose your pulpit, okay, by choice or necessity, then what we do in career planning is say your identity does not lie in that particular way you modify your skills. Your identity lies in your skills. You weren't born a preacher. You happen to identify the basic transferable skill of speaking convincingly in public to a pulpit. You get rid of the pulpit and you still speak convincingly in public. You can apply that to a number of situations. So be careful where your identity lies. Because when that gets changed, then you got to go find it again.
I always find it so important to have a nice home, you know, a pretty home, someplace, even if I'm not living in it. Mm-hmm. And I think that somehow that's my identity. I want that home there.
That says who you are. Mm-hmm. Right. Mm-hmm. I have breakfast with a guy every week. His wife insisted they buy a Taurus, T-A-U-R-U-S, Taurus, because in her mind that was always having a name. She ever got to a Taurus. So we got a Taurus now. So she's her eye. It's part of her identity.
This is an interesting case of, I think, of being in a new relationship, having been a single person and being in now a very committed relationship. There's a loss of identity of being a single person. And it goes against the world because the world is always trying to bring you together with somebody. So there's a joy in that coming together, but there's a loss in the freedom, so to speak, the self-identification, the responsibility for self. And yet the world then turns around and you lose a partner or a spouse. There's sadness in that. So of course there's incredible grief. It seems like it goes against culturally what we expect of people and what we expect in relationships.
Very good. It's interesting what the culture celebrates. Mm-hmm. Because you go to a different culture and they celebrate different kinds of passages. What do you see here?
I was thinking theologically about pastors and I can speak for an hour or two on that one, about having your identity connected to your certificate of ordination somehow, as over against having it connected to your baptism. At least in my theological system, I think it's healthier and what all to connect my ultimate identity with my baptism, not my ordination certificate. And I have my list of to-dos in terms of making a transition from being the pastor of a parish with all kinds of identity, perceived and unperceived, attached to me, and as I resign or whatever, move, I leave that behind, and still then struggle with, well, what now do I, but I get into big problems when I start looking for some thing to put that back in place to a level where it is as gratifying as, because let's face it, some jobs are, like being a pastor is a real, wow, that's a real ego builder. My goodness, what other occupation can you have? You have a captive audience every week and stand at the door and people come by and shake your hand, tell you you're wonderful and this and that and this and that and this and that. Well, for me, I at least I'm aware of that, and that you know, you can kid yourself that's something.
Yes.
I remember when I consulted with a bishop about when I was going to leave, he says, "Well, there's no problem theologically. You're going to have some problems socially, psychologically," and he was right on the target. Well, he had done it himself, of course. He went into real estate and then back to being a bishop.
Recruitment statisticians at the seminaries are noting that that's going down in our culture, prestige.
Oh, yeah.
And it's affecting recruitment.
Yeah, I noticed that with the children, they start calling me by my first name.
Yeah.
Earlier in my ministry, I was a pastor, I'm very careful about addressing. Now they call me Pastor Fritz, or not even Pastor Fritz, just Fritz.
Yeah.
You know, I always had trouble with that. I don't think I need it, but I think the office needs it. Yeah. That breakdown of respect or something that comes with the territory.
And muddy it even more. I was working with a pastor once that I can't leave because my wife said she divorced me because she married a pastor.
Ooh.
Now, that five more words your identity.
Where
is her identity?
Whoa. That's her identity.
Well, so when I'm working with people and saying get into a support group if you're going to make a career transition, they say who should be in it? I said anybody but somebody that's got a stake in keeping you where you are.
Ooh.
That anybody that doesn't have to identify with you in that role can live with, loves you enough to want you to get out of that role if it's best for you. Or you can stay in, but it doesn't make any difference to them. So that they're not, their identity doesn't lie in your role. Well, that was a rich one, talking about identity self-definition. Change of beliefs or perspective, change of sense of reality.
That's mine in a nutshell.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's right. Literally and figuratively. And psychologically, a change of perspective. Our most recent example is I like my car. I bond with my car.
No.
It's something you can camp in. It's usually foreign. And I told Lars almost 4 weeks ago, and all of a sudden I thought, let's try and live on one car. And I don't really care if I buy another one. I thought it's time because I was going through that process. Reprocess or something. And I find myself thinking about new cars again. Now, to replace it, or to change my whole perspective. I don't want to buy a new car because it can just be taken out in a second. Other experiences you've had with change of beliefs or perspective? Think Russian. What they're going through, as far as the whole ideology taken out in the air.
Or South Africa.
South Africa.
Mm-hmm.
We don't have to go that far away. I think there are many people who say that our old image of being the great world leader is a country. We are second, third rate.
Yeah.
Probably going down. So we've got to deal with that.
Wasn't Bush's State of the Union address anymore?
No.
We're number one, still number one.
You're crying.
I found an interesting thing happened when I was at seminary. I found my God sort of broadening more, and I did a year of CPE at a chemical dependency center in Hazelden in our area, I just found God so much there in the people, and it helped to broaden my view of God, and I loved it.
Mm-hmm.
But it
I was finding myself sort of aching for my old dad. It was really strange.
Yeah.
And I wasn't solid in the church at that time. I guess I wasn't in, I didn't attend the church that I belonged to. It was in another community. And I did attend some other churches around, erratically at least. And so I went on a retreat with a group from a church that I had attended just to sort of be with people that had some of that old feeling
yes.
of my old God.
Very good.
And it was wonderful.
And I think people working with changing the sexist language.
Yeah, I stumbled over that last night on that Lord's Prayer. Mm-hmm. Abba, Ima. Isn't it Ima? Isn't that Hebrew for mother?
Mm-hmm.
No, I'm not going to say that. I'm not going to say that.
I was thinking, the chaplain here, Roland Brown.
He's up there.
There he is. I was thinking about you when the person leading Vespers said people with earrings. Sing this part, people would not hear it, and I thought, oh, this guy is and that's a new perspective. Does everybody know the chaplain?
No.
Okay. There's a change of loss of sense of the future, disorientation. Because we usually extrapolate from the present into the future, when the present gets turned over, we lose our sense of the future. We don't know, literally don't know where we're going now. And that can be terribly disorienting to there are any orienteering people here. It means we've lost our compass, we've lost our map. Where am I going? I thought this was the way life operated. So, where am I going? Okay. Another word that I kind of like, that in between time, the Hebrews called tohu va-bohu, and that meant the way it was before God created. The water and the ground were all mixed up, and nobody knew where anything was clustered together, and then God created and set the lines in the world. There's an up now and a down, a dry and a wet, and like that. And we're kind of in those tohu va-bohu situations sometimes, waiting for the new creation to happen in the future, waiting to move into that new creation where things will be set straight, things will be set right.
I was just thinking on that for myself. When the time came and I suddenly realized that I had my health and I was financially secure and I had pretty much resigned obligations to other people and so on. And then it's like, wow! You know, I never expected to be in that situation. I expected to be married and a mother and a wife and all of these things until they started dying out. I never thought I'd be stepping out. My kids refer to me as, yes, this is my mom. She's run away to a commune. But, which is fun for them. But the thing about it is that when I started really thinking about what do I want to do next, I didn't even know what my options were. You talk about being disoriented. I have no idea of how many possibilities I didn't explore because I'm just not aware of them. And so I'm still, you know, in that very, very open stage without a life plan. Never in my life had I been without some kind of a life plan. Obviously, I'm going to go to college. Obviously, I'm going to get married. Certainly, I'll have children. I'm going to do this and this and this and this. And all of a sudden, to be in this state where, who knows, I might go for the Lutheran diaconate for a year. I might apply to the Peace Corps. I might, God save us, get a job. You know, I have no idea what's going to happen. And I don't even know what's out there. And that's a real sense of disorientation. It's joyful, but it's like, I sure hate to think I missed out on something better somewhere down the road. It's an odd sense.
What about vocational counseling?
Oh, then I'd have to start thinking about making a commitment, wouldn't I? Yes, you're right. That is something I'm definitely going to have to do some thinking about. Of course, if I wait long enough, it'll be a moot point.
Are you one of the IMF people?
No, actually, I'm very different from an IMF.
That sounds like a very key description. Now, I don't want to put you in. Yeah, sometimes we don't want to make a plan because it closes off all this neat new stuff that's coming in.
I was just laughing, I'm an ENTJ.
No, wait a second, where are all the codes?
That was my first question when I started hearing him flop tossing letters.
Confusion, emptiness can be another aspect of the enemy. We talk a lot about emptiness, but just the confusion. And that might lead you to think that you're back in adolescence. Remember, our perception of life used to be Freudian, in that you have your personality blocks pretty much in place by the time you're three. You go into a long period, including latency, and then they get shaken up again when you're an adolescent. And then you're set in cement. Okay, you get one job and stay with it until you're 65, unless you're flighty. And that's
unstable.
How it is.
Unstable.
Yeah. And Erickson comes along and says, hey, there's stages of development in adult life. So what's happening here is you feel like you're moving through adolescence again, if you're thinking the Freudian way. And you think you're regressing. And what's really happening is you're just getting the new creation ready. That's what's happening. Rearranging things in here in a new way you hadn't thought of before, so you can get into a new environment out there or enhance your current environment, modify it a little bit. Endings are experiences of dying. With all the grief and hope of the resurrection that entails, that's what they are. Little experiences of dying. Leaving the party. I'm going to distribute to you.
This isn't homework. There's three sheets to a packet. You just take three sheets off of there.
I'm thinking again about your current.
It's collated already. Just take the top three sheets there.
Oh, okay.
We have categorized every feeling word we could think of. When you get your packet, just take the one off the top and pass them on. Thinking about your current major transition, whichever one you want to concentrate on, just sift through there, and it can be very helpful to get specific about what you're experiencing. Circle those words that most specifically say what you are feeling now in your current transition.